Well, this is obviously pretty casual, so feel free to interrupt whenever about whatever. I'd like to talk to you today about long-range triggering, which is something that I've spent some amount of time studying, when earthquakes trigger other earthquakes hundreds of kilometers away. And I think it can give us an interesting observational window into earthquake initiation. So the basic phenomenon I'm going to talk about was first really well established in 1992 following the Landers earthquake. And this is a remake of a rather famous figure from Dave Hill and others, where they looked at the Landers earthquake in Southern California. And the Landers earthquake, this whited out area is what would normally be considered the conventional aftershock zone of the Landers earthquake, extending about 100 kilometers around the fault length. And what they noticed was something rather spectacular, that the blue dots are seismicity 10 days before the Landers earthquake in the western U.S. and the red dots are 10 days after. And there was this rather spectacular lighting up of the western U.S. after Landers, which was completely unexpected. Nobody thought earthquakes could make other earthquakes at those sorts of distances. This was the stuff of charlatans and TV hosts. It wasn't something that scientists did. But turns out they can. And since the time of Landers, we've seen this sort of long-range triggering in a number of other cases. Over here is one that I happen to work on, which is Greece following the Izmit earthquake in 99, where what's shown here is the seismicity in a particular catalog in Greece on each day of 1999, day 219, day 220, day 221. And the Izmit earthquake occurred very conveniently just about midnight GMT, between 228 and 229. And you can see this widespread increase in seismicity. The number of earthquakes is statistically significant at the 5% level. That is, only 5% of the days have such a large amount of seismicity in it, in the catalog. But more interestingly, any other day that has so much seismicity is some sort of isolated main shock aftershock sequence, whereas on day 229 of 1999, we see a large number of earthquakes all over Greece. And so it seems to be associated with the Izmit earthquake in Turkey, which occurred just off the edge of this map here. Okay?
Other scales that I'm used to thinking in degrees or something?
Well, 1 degree is 111 kilometers. Okay. Okay. Yeah, so that helped. Yeah, it's a bit clearer on my screen, unfortunately, than the projector here, but that is Greece.
Is the dot size and magnitude over here?
What dot?
On the Landers. What's the magnitude of those?
Oh, the magnitude, most of these guys are sort of twos and threes, the relatively small microseismicity. One thing that was noticed right away, and we'll come back to, following Landers, is most of the places that lit up were places like Long Valley Caldera, a big volcanic field, the geysers, geothermal areas. Yellowstone also lit up. And so we'll come back to that idea. Data got better over time, and following the 2002 Denali earthquake, we had a number of broadband seismometers in the western U.S., and we were able to document this triggering even more closely than we were able to before by looking directly at the waveforms. And so what you're looking at here is a seismogram recorded in Montana from this earthquake in Alaska. And so what you're predominantly seeing here are the surface waves coming on through from the earthquake in Alaska. And then the middle panel is the same data, which has gone through a high-pass filter. Okay, notice we've changed Y scales here. Okay, and so when you take a high-pass filter, what you're doing is you're isolating the high-frequency signals, so the local earthquakes, and you're filtering out these long-period surface waves that came from Alaska. And so you're left with only things that are happening relatively near your seismic station. And what you see is, as the surface waves come through, we have all these local earthquakes. These actually turn out to be mainly Yellowstone events. The station's pretty close to Yellowstone. And if we zoom in on any one of these spikes, we can start to see that they have P waves and S waves. They're well-defined earthquakes. We can locate them. And they are, in fact, located, as I've mentioned, in Yellowstone, mainly, not Alaska. So that sort of ties the knot very nicely that, in fact, it is the Denali earthquake that's doing the triggering. And as the surface waves come through is when the triggering starts. So it's the seismic waves that are doing the triggering. So what I want to talk to you about today is, I just did a little bit of an overview of long-range triggering. I want to try to summarize a few observational facts about long-range triggering. I then will suggest very briefly, not going to dwell on this part of the talk, a mechanism based on water well studies, and hopefully I'll motivate why it's a good idea to look at water wells to solve this problem. And I'll spend a bunch of time on the third part, which is triggering thresholds and further evidence on the effects of very small stresses. And this, to some extent, is going to be the take-home message today, which is these incredibly small stresses of the seismic waves are quite capable of making earthquakes. And this is the mechanical question that's really being posed by this data. My emphasis today, as I said, I'm going to sort of downplay some of the mechanism issues and really focus on the observational data, because I figure for this audience, mechanisms are things that you're experts in, and maybe something I could bring to the table is a bit more observational data that I focused on. And I'm hoping to get a lot of feedback on mechanisms from all of you. So fact number one about long-range triggering is that it's the seismic waves that are doing the triggering. And we know this from a couple of lines of evidence. First of all, that the seismic waves are the largest potential stress that we have to do the triggering. That if, for instance, we take the case that I talked about in Greece from the Izmit earthquake, the seismic waves have very large stresses on the order of a few bars, 0.2 megapascals, whereas things like the static stress just from having the dislocation of the Turkish earthquake at these distances are extremely small. And so dynamic stresses are the key to the understanding this problem. The static stresses are smaller even than tidal stresses, which we do not typically trigger earthquakes. The other line of evidence that it's the seismic waves that are doing the triggering is also simply timing. That Denali plot, I'm hoping, was fairly convincing that the earthquakes are, in fact, beginning as the surface waves come on through. And we see that at a number of sites by now. We saw it all over the place from Denali. We see it from Sumatra. We've seen it from a number of cases in the geysers. It's the seismic waves that are doing the triggering. Fact number two is that long-range triggering is more often observed in volcanic or geothermal areas. And I'm going to try to say this fairly carefully because this is a fairly controversial point. And the first point I made is not so controversial. Long-range triggering, I think everybody accepts it has to be seismic waves. But this is a little bit more controversial. It seemed obvious after Landers that most of the places that lit up were volcanic or geothermal, but since that time people have waffled on whether or not this is a geothermal or volcanic phenomenon. If you tabulate just number of reported cases in the literature, the vast majority are volcanic or geothermal, 85%. the ones that are tectonic tend to be historical cases where there's not as robust documentation that might say that that's not necessarily an observation we want to trust. Or it might say simply that remote triggering is more common in volcanic and geothermal areas. It's easier to happen there, but it's not exclusively in volcanic and geothermal areas.
Yeah, Emily, how did you, what does this data mean? Cases, for example, in Landers, there was a lot of triggering in volcanic and geothermal areas, but it looked like there was some triggering in non-volcanic areas that did. Did you do any hair splitting, or is this Landers earthquake is one of those 25 in the?
No, there's a certain amount of hair splitting here. I think a lot of the places people have called non-volcanic or non-geothermal, I would disagree with the classification. But that's sort of the next slide. Even if you do sort of take it at face value, that Nevada is not geothermal and everything else is, there's still vastly more documented cases in geothermal areas. We can have a longer discussion on this. There's also a, as I said, this is a controversial issue. There's also a paper that came out of the Denali earthquake that claimed that there was triggering in non-geothermal areas. And if you look closely at those records, it's simply not true. That if you take the P minus S times of the key stations that were claimed to be non-geothermal, and the main one was a place called Sail Mountain, SLEM is the station name, and you take the P minus S time, then you open the Smithsonian Volcano Catalog, there's a volcano there. So. But there are some biases in making this statement, which is why part of the reason it's controversial. Which is that there are some network biases. The dense seismometer networks tend to be located on volcanoes. People put a lot more short period networks on volcanoes, and these are the best kinds of networks to pick up triggering on because you catch little tiny earthquakes, and as I mentioned before, it's really a lot of microseismicity that's being triggered, so you want a nice, really good, dense, short period network. So there is an observational bias. However, there are some densely instrumented tectonic areas that do not trigger, like Parkfield. So I don't think it's observational bias that's throwing us off here. There's another much more subtle issue, which is that faults generate hot springs. One of the good ways to find a fault is to go look for hot water coming out of the ground. That faults form barriers hydrologically and bring deep water to the surface and therefore have hot springs on them. And so there's a little bit of potentially circular reasoning that if I'm saying that geothermal areas are where there's triggering and we already knew earthquakes happen in faults, there's potentially a problem there that virtually every fault could in some sense be considered a geothermal area. I think this is part of the issue at Dixie Valley, which is one of the places that Jim was referring to. But if you go to Dixie Valley, there are fumaroles coming out of the fault. So I call that geothermal. So in my sense, what I mean by geothermal here is has hot water involved. And as I've pointed out, some places that people have normally thought of as tectonic, there are fumaroles, which are steam vents, sulfur deposits coming out of the fault, so there certainly is hot water involved at shallow levels. Okay, the second caveat here is geothermal is not by itself sufficient to trigger. And we can that even though it seems that geothermal areas are easier to trigger than other areas, that's not the whole story. And we know this because we took a look at Japan. And you would think Japan would be a great place to look for long-range triggering, right? It's got lots of earthquakes, so no shortage of things to trigger. And lots of seismometers, no shortage of instruments to pick it up. And lots of geothermal areas and lots of volcanic areas. But oddly enough, Japan does not trigger at comparable levels to the Western U.S. That is, given the same amount of shaking, if you look across a catalog of the same region, you do not see the same strength signal. It might be some local pockets in Japan that trigger here and there, but the signal is not overall as strong as the Western U.S. signal. And that's what I'm trying to show in this graph that my student Rebecca Harrington did, that these are seismicity, number of earthquakes per day from Denali, Hector, Mine, and Landis, which are three earthquakes that had long-range triggering in the Western U.S. And here are earthquakes with comparable shaking in Japan, and I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to identify where the main shock was just by looking at the time series here. So clearly there's more to the story. Facts 3 and 4 about long-range triggering are sort of intertwined, which is that the seismicity persists beyond the duration of the seismic waves. That is that this is an observation, this is one of the first observations of long-range triggering from Long Valley, from the Landers earthquake. This is from Hill et al. And they saw, here is cumulative number of earthquakes, and so you can see this elevated level of seismicity persisted for several days after the Landers earthquake. It didn't just happen while the waves were there and then shut off. And also, there are other observables that change at the time of earthquake. In particular, at Long Valley, there is a deformation signal that tilt meters and a strain meter showed large persistent deformation signals that went over that continued for a few days afterwards. This deformation signal is essentially unique. It's never been seen for any other site for any other earthquake, which is too bad because that's giving us another set of data and another window into what this triggering process might be all about. But there are other data sets that do have observable signals from long-range triggering, and I'll come back to that in 1 second.
Why is this surprising? Because you expect that if you have a long, very weak signal from an earthquake far away that triggered the first one, local earthquakes that then be subsequently triggered should trigger the neighbors and such.
That's this slide. Yes. Surprising is a subjective judgment, but this is something that people have spent a lot of time worrying about with long-range triggering, is whether or not you need some sort of local deformation pulse, which seemed to be consistent with the original Long Valley data, or whether or not everything that happened subsequently is merely an aftershock of what happened originally. And that has a different implication in terms of constraining mechanisms. Do you need something that the seismic waves somehow make a permanent change in the system, or do you just need that temporary stress to let a runaway process start off?
I think the point also is, isn't it, that those deformation signals are much too large to have been caused by the local seismicity, right?
That's another point, yes.
A large signal compared to the seismicity that was going on.
I'm giving two different talks here at once. But in response to Jay's point is, yes, this persistent nature of the seismicity is something that has puzzled people. And so one thing you could do is go back to the statistics of the seismicity and say, well, are the statistics of the seismicity consistent with an aftershock sequence? Is this more or less, no more or less mysterious than the prolonged nature of aftershock sequences? That the initial the seismic waves trigger some local earthquake, which then trigger lots of other earthquakes. That's not to say that we understand the rest of that process, but at least it's consistent with our earlier framework. And the answer is yes, that the persistent nature of the seismicity still follows the statistics of Amari's law, which is what's shown in this graph, there aren't that many sites where you could actually do this kind of statistic. This is all of the sites where you measure more than 40 earthquakes in the first hour, which is just a somewhat arbitrary criteria I use for doing the statistics. Here's cumulative number of earthquakes versus log time. So a line on this plot is goes as log time, and so therefore it's Omari's law. And in fact, even for Long Valley, oddly enough, that persistent seismicity is consistent with Omari's law. Okay. Coming back to the other observables question, if we want to explain this, maybe we need to branch out our investigation beyond just looking at seismograms. If we have other observable data sets that change at the time of earthquakes.
Excuse me, what was the space window in this previous slide here with Omari's law?
I'm sorry?
The space window.
This was done by picking them off the waveforms. So what I did was, because catalogs directly after major earthquakes are terrible, so you can't do it in the conventional way. So what the reason there are only so few here is this is where there happened to be broadband seismometers close enough to a triggered swarm. And so what I did was anything that made a signal above a certain level amplitude on that broadband waveform in a high pass filter, I counted as an earthquake. So it's not, it's a consistent completeness threshold because it has to be monitored on a particular seismometer, but it's not the usual kind of space-time window that you would use for this sort of thing. These are from a deployment that I did in the geysers, and this is from a publicly available seismometer at Long Valley. So another thing what you could do, as I started to say, is try to look at other corroborating data. And just about the only other observable that really changes at the time of faraway earthquakes is water level in wells. And not all wells do this, but some wells, some of the time, have really large changes in water level in response to earthquake. This has been known for a long time. Here's just over a 3-foot drop in water level in a well in Florida in response to the 1964 Alaska earthquake. So these are not subtle changes. These are things that are easily measured, easily observed. And it might be useful to actually understand this effect, because here is yet another thing that seismic waves do far away. And part of the reason it might be useful to understand this is because we've been saying a lot of things over the last, half hour that have to do with pore pressure. I said that seismicity happens more easily in geothermal areas, and triggered seismicity happens more easily in geothermal areas, so that's places where there are lots of hot fluids. So again, trying to understand how seismic waves interact with those hot fluids might be important to this problem. And also, we know that elevating pore pressure is a great way to make earthquakes, right? If you elevate pore pressure, we can induce seismicity. We see that artificially, and we understand it theoretically. If you elevate pore pressure, you reduce the frictional strength, and away you go. So to look at this water well effect, we went to a particular well that my colleagues instrumented in Grants Pass, Oregon, and which has recorded a number of these large water level steps in response to earthquakes. Sometimes they're rapid steps, like from this Oaxaca earthquake. Sometimes they're more gradual steps, like this Petrolia earthquake. The interesting thing about the instrumentation.
Sorry, in that same well, so one time it might go up and another time it might go down.
That well is always down. Most wells tend to always be down or always be up.
Sorry, can you just look at that slide back again?
I think you're looking at the recovery.
Yeah, I'm looking at the recovery.
You're looking at the recovery from Oaxaca. The actual, during the earthquake, it goes down.
an overshoots in some sense.
Yes, you can model the recovery in a confined, a laterally confined aquifer, that once you have a pore pressure step down, it'll recover. Basically, you flex up the boundary.
So I'm a little confused about the combination of the seismicity as the trigger, which is a very sudden event and instantaneous pressure, versus water level changes, which are going to be more of a static phenomenon. So if you have this trigger, so is the seismicity going to be related to this long-term drop, which was triggered by the seismicity, or?
I think that's where we're going. Hang on to that question for about 4 slides, and if you still have it, ask again.
Okay.
What's happening here is the earthquakes, the big earthquakes, the main shocks far away, are making the water level drop, and I want to understand why the water level drops from the seismic waves, and then I'm going to try to tie that back into making new earthquakes locally.
Okay.
That's the framework here. So one thing that's exceptional about this particular well is that it's instrumented to record water level at very high sample rates, 1 sample per second. And this is a very weird thing. If any of you ever do any hydrology, you know that nobody ever instruments wells to sample at 1 sample per second. But my colleagues are very clever people, and so they did. And what they got were these wellograms, water level oscillations, and which you can compare to a seismogram on a nearby seismometer. This one happens to be from the Hector Mine earthquake. And so the water level oscillates in response to the seismic waves. It looks a whole lot like a seismogram. What's happening here is the water level is mainly responding to the dilatational strain in the wave. And the strain is squeezing the sponge that is the aquifer and squeezing water out of the sponge. And as it as the dilatational wave passes through, that squeezes the water level up and down and up and down and up and down.
Really the dilatational strain now? I mean, it's clearly the strain, but you can put a shear strain on an oriented crack and it's going to squeeze it. I imagine these must be surface waves and stuff. So it's really a shear.
It's quite possible for you're completely right in saying that an anisotropic system can respond in pore pressure to shear stress. As it turns out, you can do an amazingly good job of fitting the response functions from just the dilatational strain from the Rayleigh waves. I've often thought that there might be some interesting information to get about orientation from cracks from exactly what you suggested, but for this purpose, you can do a great job with just the dilatational strain.
The fact that water's moving in and out of the wellbore so fast must mean that it's mostly cracks that are working, I would think, and not normal porosities.
Well, yes. One thing you notice right away is that this is effectively a low-pass filter. This you've lost the high-frequency signal, and so that's telling you about something about what Jim just said, that as you're squeezing the water in and out of the aquifer. How easily it travels to the well depends on the permeability. And so really fast oscillations never get to the well. And really long period oscillations are transmitted more easily and generate a flow on the appropriate time scale. So this filtering effect is actually a measure of permeability in the aquifer. And that's going to become very important to our story. One thing we wanted to do is to understand that how much information we can extract from that response function of wellogram over seismogram. I just said the filtering effect tells you something about permeability. Let's try to do this really quantitatively. So first thing we did is try to characterize the well by other means, the aquifer system. We did a conventional pump test, which is you pump water out of the well and you see how fast the water drops in the well. If it drops as fast as you pump it out, that means that the aquifer is very impermeable. If the water level doesn't drop at all, it means that the aquifer is infinitely permeable, right? Because it's recharging as fast as you're pumping it out, and anywhere between gives you a measure. And so we did this in this well, and it turned out that we were able to fit the pump test data extremely well by modeling the aquifer as a single fracture, hydrologically speaking, a single fracture, embedded in an infinite homogeneous isotropic space. Notice that this model has very few parameters, just the size of the fracture and the permeability and storage of the surrounding aquifer. Of course, it makes a lot of sense in the case of this well to model the aquifer as a fracture. The well happens to be drilled in fractured granite, like shown in this nearby quarry. So there's some reality check here. So we go ahead and, using that hydrological model, compute what we think that the response function should be. That is, the response of the wellogram to the size strain and the size of the gram to the dilatational strain and the size of the gram as a function of period. And we get, this is the calculated response, and here it is graphically. And we compare it to our actual records of wellogram, seismogram. And you see that we do pretty well. Blue with the error bars is actual data. Green is the predicted fit. There might be a slight underestimate, and I suspect that's probably because we're not including the shear coupling. But overall, we're doing just fine from dilatational strain. So the reason I just took this rather long detour through hydrology is because I wanted to be able to say something quantitative from the response of wellograms to seismograms, because we actually observe it changing over time. And we observe it during one of these co-seismic water level steps. This is a zoom in of the water level step that you saw in the beginning from Oaxaca, the one Bruce was asking questions about, that rapid drop down. And when you look at it on a time scale of, here's a scale bar of 100 seconds, you see something very strange, which is that prior to the step, there's essentially no response to the wellogram to the seismic waves, even though there are plenty of waves coming through. Then after the step, it responds normally. And just for reference, this is what I mean by normally. Here's wellogram, seismogram for another earthquake, Hector Mine earthquake. Everything here, wells on the same y-axis, ground velocity on the same y-axis. Well, that's weird. I mean, the first 10 times I saw this, I thought, we've got a dead instrument there. But something's malfunctioning at the site. But I don't think that's actually the case. We actually have redundant instrumentation. The instrumentation was still responding to tidal response, to tidal fluctuations. The instruments were working. This really happened.
Aren't just exciting the crack? The first wiggles don't do much, and then all of a sudden the thing excites, starts to oscillate now in phase with the driving, getting longer, getting progressively longer. It's like a fatigue crack, so the water level drops.
That, if you want, if you're thinking about it, I don't think you should think about these oscillations directly as being the oscillations of a crack, because we just went through, although I did it quickly, that the oscillations are a direct response to the dilatational strain in a flat-out linear pore elastic sense. So we actually understand that. No, but you're going to say that it's a crack growth problem. That would be one possible explanation to increase what effectively is increasing the permeability here. The problem with that explanation is that the system recovers. So this is the unusual response. This is the normal response afterwards. And so, and we see this for more than one earthquake, that the weird thing is beforehand, then it opens up,
It didn't recover. The water level didn't go back.
It actually... I'm going to show you what I think is going on, and then we'll come back to your question, and I think you'll see what my problem with that explanation is. This is just a zoom in on the water level response around the time of the step. And you see, you do actually have a little bit of response before the step, but not much. And then a normal response afterwards. So going back to our formalism for relating wellogram over seismogram responses, we could translate that into an effective permeability, right? So the idea here is that we had an unusually low permeability before the step, and then we go back to our normal level of permeability afterwards. So what I think is happening here is that the well is sampling a fracture, as we established from a hydrological test. And fractures are very conductive, and so normally the pressure along the fracture is more or less constant if you measure the water water pressure going down a line along the fracture. From time to time, for reasons completely unrelated to earthquakes, this fracture clots up. It silts up with dirt, with particulates, with clays, all sorts of things. And it makes barriers. And so then, when a barrier forms, the well is sampling a much smaller subset of the fracture, and therefore, since there's a smaller part of the fracture feeding the well, the response is less than normal. And also, when these barriers form, there's variations in pore pressure along the fracture. In particular, there's a higher pore pressure on the upstream side and lower pore pressure on the downstream side. And so what I think the earthquake is doing is driving a flow. We've already seen that earthquakes are very good at driving flows in and out of wells. So it drives a flow that washes away this barrier and returns the response to normal, and also lets the pore pressure drop back down to normal. I'm open to the crack idea. And you'll see that it might explain other pieces of data better that we'll be talking about in a minute. But I really have a whole big problem with the healing process of the crack. And maybe we could talk about that in the discussion time. So the implications of this whole well study for seismicity are that what I'm proposing is that there exist these steps in natural hydrological systems that redistribute pore pressure on fractures or equivalently faults, generating seismicity by rapidly reducing the strength locally. Moreover, what does this have to do with our whole long-range triggering problem in geothermal areas? These sorts of barriers can form much more easily in geothermal areas than elsewhere, because there's rapid precipitation in geothermal areas. There's always minerals coming out of these chemically rich solutions, which can form thicker barriers and therefore larger pressure changes. Therefore, using the numbers from this Grants Pass site and typical precipitation rates for geothermal areas, we predict that we can get something like half a bar of pressure change from evacuating these barriers, which would be sufficient to trigger earthquakes according to what we think we know from static stress studies. All right, so we're finally up to talking about mechanisms. So I've just thrown out a mechanism at you for long-range triggering. Obviously, I'm not the only one to have thrown out a mechanism, and it's not even the only mechanism I've thrown out there. So what are the other possibilities? How are we making these earthquakes far away from the seismic waves? One thing we might be doing is having frictional instabilities. Maybe we have some sort of velocity weakening effect, and as the transient stresses come through, they temporarily weaken frictional surfaces and then allow an instability to take place. maybe we have subcritical crack growth, that the rate of growth of a subcritical crack depends on its length, and what's happening is the seismic waves come through, temporarily stress subcritical cracks, which makes them grow longer, and as the cracks grow longer, they become more and more, they grow faster and faster and faster into a runaway process. A number of people have suggested bubble pressurization mechanisms, really picking up on this idea that triggering seems to happen more easily in geothermal and volcanic areas. I'm not going to talk about that much today. I'm happy to entertain questions about that later, but the basic idea there is perhaps volatiles are pumped into bubbles, increasing pressurization in a bubbly flow. And now I've just suggested to you that maybe we have some sort of fracture unclogging mechanism. What do we do? How do we start trying to observationally distinguish between these mechanisms? Well, one way to try to distinguish between mechanisms is to try to find a threshold for triggering, right? If we can know not only what amplitude waves, but what kinds of waves, whether it's the amplitude of a seismic wave or the total energy of a seismic wave or waves at a particular frequency, what aspects of waves are responsible for triggering? And then, secondarily, what values of those thresholds are applicable? That would give us some insight into mechanism and might help us distinguish between these possibilities. So your first guess, and my first guess, is there's some sort of magic amplitude of waves. That if shaking gets above a certain level, you trigger earthquakes. And strictly speaking, that doesn't seem to be the case. We investigated these thresholds by taking a look at Long Valley Caldera, which is a place that is triggered repeatedly, and comparing earthquakes that triggered and did not trigger seismicity and the caldera. And what we found is that if you just compare two of our best documented earthquakes to each other, Denali and Northridge, Northridge had stronger shaking locally than Denali, yet Denali triggered and Northridge didn't. So it's not flat out amplitude, at least not in a very simple sense. You could do this more carefully, using more than just two earthquakes. We did a whole suite of earthquakes. This was with my collaborator, Stephanie Prejean, and compared those that triggered that those that didn't and their peak velocity, both in vertical and horizontal. And you see that if you try to draw some threshold across this bar graph, separating those that trigger from those that don't, you simply can't do it. That there isn't a clean amplitude threshold for triggering.
Same site, but the same size mountain.
Yes. There's one exception. There's a Hector mine that had to be extrapolated from another site. There are some subtleties there, but they've all been corrected to the same site. So, okay. So maybe it's not just peak amplitude. Maybe it's total energy in the waves. After all, something that shakes longer might very reasonably have a better chance of triggering than something that shakes at a high amplitude but just for a short time. And so maybe if we just measure the total energy in a wave train passing on through Long Valley and compare the energy for Denali to Northridge or any of these other earthquakes, we'll be able to define a threshold. Seems like a reasonable hypothesis, right? You all, nobody said right. Anybody with me? Okay. Well, that turns out not to work too well either. And we can see it doesn't work well if we calculate the energy that has passed through Long Valley Caldera from these seismograms at this one particular site. look at the time when triggering began and how much energy had passed through this region by the time triggering started. And what we find is for the Denali earthquake, triggering began very, very early on the wave train. When the cumulative energy that had passed through Long Valley Caldera was incredibly small, smaller than the total energy for any of these other earthquakes that did not trigger. Triggering begins when the cumulative energy that had passed through Long Valley was less than 200 joule seconds per meter squared. So energy by itself seems to be a pretty crappy threshold too. And this surprised me. I was sure this was going to work. Nope. So what about waves at a particular frequency? Now we seem to be making some progress. What you see here are spectra of, again, the same site at Long Valley Caldera of the seismic wave train as a spectrum, as a function of period here. And the thick lines are the earthquakes that triggered, and the thin lines are ones that did not. And you see that although the spectrum at high frequency, short periods, for some of these thick lines is less than for the thin lines, at long periods, they're pretty cleanly separated. The thick lines have lots of long period energy, the thin lines do not.
What's the grid?
There's some sort of color translation between my screen, the screen and my screen going on. It's supposed to be a spectrum of color going from blue up here to red down here.
Okay.
So they're just different earthquakes. And so
the red are less frequent.
Yes, this is an order of magnitude. Okay. So it's not terribly surprising, actually, that the big earthquakes, Denali, Landers, Hector, Mine, have lots of long period energy. They may be further away and therefore have less high frequency energy reaching the site, but they have lots more long period energy because they were bigger earthquakes.
So your Willigram showed defective filtering.
You've already seen my talk. No, you haven't, but hang on. So we seem to be suggesting here some sort of frequency dependent threshold, that if we just look at the long period energy, long period amplitude, I'm sorry, that if we filter the waveform first and then try to make a threshold, we do a whole lot better. And so that's what the yellow bars are down here, is a low pass version of the seismogram. And for the low pass version, we can really separate out these three triggerers on the left hand side from the non-triggerers, no problem. That there's a nice clean threshold in long period shaking. So, what's that mean physically? Well, one effect that's at play here is actually pretty trivial and perhaps not terribly interesting, except for from a pragmatic point of view, which is that what we measure on the surface on a seismogram has a lot more high frequency energy than what we met the shaking experienced by the proto earthquakes at depth. That high frequency surface waves have much more stronger shaking at the surface than at depth. And so if we try to correct these seismograms for the amount of shaking that would be experienced on the fault, we to a large extent explain this filtering effect. So these are the corrected seismograms. The blue bars are the corrected seismograms, so peak amplitude shaking, corrected to depth of earthquakes and at 3 kilometers. And you can see that we're very close to be able to draw a line across the blue separating triggering from non-triggering, but we can't quite do it. And we can't quite do it because of Northridge again. It's this whole Northridge Denali thing coming back to haunt. So sort of here on out, what I'm going to say about Long Valley Caldera depends on this difference between Denali and Northridge, which I fully admit is, you know, two earthquakes. And so it depends on how important you think that difference is, which subjectively I think is pretty important because those are two of the best recorded earthquakes we have. But take the next couple slides with a grain of salt. If you say apply a low pass filter again to these already depth filtered waves, you still are able to define a threshold in the yellow bars, the low pass filtered version. So if there's another low pass filter in addition to depth, then we've got a good threshold. Well, as Jay already pointed out, I've already introduced you to one low pass filter over the course of this talk, which is this hydrological effect. That as you squeeze water in and out of an aquifer, the long period waves are much more effective at making pore pressure oscillations in the fracture or fault than the high frequency waves. So maybe that's what's going on here. Maybe the long period waves are oscillating, are being felt as pore pressure oscillations in the fault, and then ultimately are able to make failure through a weakening mechanism, whereas the high frequency waves just never have any effect. And so we could go ahead and calculate what the pore pressure effect for Denali and Northridge would be in a fault with some typical parameters that, given the Northridge and Denali seismograms, I use that response function very similar to the one that I derived for the well in Oregon, slightly modified for a closed fault, to derive what we would expect the pore pressure oscillations to be inside the fault in response to these earthquakes. And you see that we're able to get Denali to be at least comparable, just very slightly larger than Northridge. I would have liked this to be a more, you know, exciting difference and discrepancy, that Denali was way bigger than Northridge, but this is the way it turned out. And so perhaps this is giving us the additional filtering effect that we need to explain the threshold. Okay, coming back to other mechanisms. And I'm sorry I'm running slightly over here. We started slightly late, but I'll try to wrap up pretty quickly. Part of the problem of quantitatively making Earth the increase in seismicity rate from other mechanisms like frictional instability or subcritical crack growth is the stresses of the seismic waves are really very, very small. I kept showing you stress peak ground velocity of around 1 centimeter per second, which is equivalent to about a bar of stress. So these are not big stresses. So if we wanted to play this game and try to predict from, say, rate and state friction what the background stress would have to be in order to create the observed number of the observed increase in seismicity, we would get the following results. So what I'm doing is I'm taking the input stresses from the seismogram, I'm normalizing it by a background stress, which is a variable. And it's variable because the background stress is the lithostatic minus the pore pressure. The pore pressure, I'm just letting be whatever we want, whatever we need to have to solve this problem. And I'm saying, what's it going to have to be, the lithostatic minus the pore pressure, to get the observed number of triggered earthquakes from Denali at Long Valley, given the observed input stresses? And so the dashed line is the observed number of earthquakes, and so that requires an effective stress of a bar or two. So that means that the pore pressure is 99.9% of lithostatic, incredibly high pore pressures.
You must have some model for generating numbers of earthquakes.
It's your model.
It would give the same answer, but okay.
I think I sent you the code. It's basically the idea is the observed number of earthquakes is coming, it's the observed rate increase normalized by a background rate increase. Okay, now we're good? Yeah, and the background rate is getting inferred from the overall catalog for Long Valley.
We can talk about
okay. So you can explain it by some sort of frictional instability model, but you do need really, really high pore pressures to make it happen. And you know, this is Long Valley Caldera. Maybe there are really high pore pressures there. The problem I have with this is that there are places out there that we do get large triggering that we don't think there are high pore pressure. Long Valley Caldera is a very active geothermal system which has evidence for pressurized fluids at depth. But we also get lots of triggering at a place called the Geysers in Northern California. I showed you some records from them there earlier when we were talking about Omari's Law. And the Geysers is a vapor static system. It's actually underpressurized. So although high pore pressure might be our way to explain the triggering from low amplitudes at Long Valley, I don't think it works in general. Okay, I will not be offended if anybody wants to get up and leave right now, but I'd like to just give you one more piece of evidence very quickly that small stresses are important, and I was hoping to get some feedback on this part of the talk. We have another way to measure the effect of small dynamic stresses on rocks, and that is by looking at tidal responses of water wells. So now I'm going to go back to looking at water wells, back to doing hydrology, but I'm not really interested in the water. I'm just using this as a probe and an instrumental probe of the degree of fracturing of rock. And so the basic idea here is that we're looking at a very long time series of water level from a place called Pinyon Flats. This is data from Duncan Agnew at Pinyon Flats Geophysical Observatory. And we're looking at the response of the water level to solid earth tides. So you see this sort of fuzz on the water level when you zoom in. Those are tidal oscillations. So we have regular strains being imposed by the solid earth tides, and that's squeezing water in and out of the well, very much like the seismic waves did. And so very much like the seismic waves did, we could use this to infer permeability. In this case, the way to measure permeability is to look at the phase lag between the imposed tidal dilatational strain and the observed water level changes. If the aquifer is completely permeable, then there should be a very short phase lag, that the what you see as water level response in the well is completely in phase with the imposed strain. If the aquifer is very impermeable, the other way around, very long phase lag. And so we measure phase lag as a function of time in 28-day windows over about the last 20 years or so. And we saw something, and actually my student John L. Curry really noticed this, really very, very surprising, which is that these dashed lines are major regional earthquakes in Southern California. And look at these big phase lag changes at the time of earthquakes. The convention here is negative is an increase in phase lag. So as these peaks go up, we're getting closer to in phase, so more permeable. So at the time of earthquakes, the rock at Pinyon Flats in this shallow aquifer, about 200 meters down, is getting more permeable. Well, that's pretty cool. Even cooler is the fact that it's getting more permeable in a really predictable way. On the x-axis here is a peak ground velocity measured from seismograms at Pinyon Flats. And on the y-axis is permeability change as inferred from the tidal response. And this is for two different wells on the site. And look at that. They're nice lines. The larger the ground shaking, and ground shaking is a proxy for dynamic stress, And just to remind you, centimeter per second is 0.1 megapascals bar, so very small stresses. Larger the shaking, the larger the permeability increase. This is just gross peak ground velocity in a fairly gross way. So, no filtering other than there are some instrumental issues involved, but no purposeful filtering. So that's another piece of evidence that very small stressors are doing really major things to fractures. These are factors of three increase in the permeability in the system. These are big effects. From stresses that are very small, and in this particular case, we know we don't have elevated pore pressure because we're measuring water level. We know exactly what the pore pressure is. It's hydrostatic. So from relatively, large stresses and, small stresses and large changes. Okay. So to wrap it up here, I've talked about a bunch of different mechanisms, or very briefly touched on a couple of different mechanisms for long-range triggering. Where are we? What's the state of health of these mechanisms? The friction and sort of equivalently subcritical crack growth both work if pore pressure is very high, which might be the case in some sites, but it certainly seems like we have triggering in cases where it's not very high, so it's a little bit problematic. Bubble pressurization mechanisms are out. I didn't really have a chance to talk about that today, but if you think about it, the pumping of gas volatiles into bubbles depends on the number of cycles very strongly, and amplitude. It should have been an energy effect, and so by eliminating energy effects, we eliminated the bubble pressurization mechanism. And unclogging of fractures is still okay. I haven't managed to get rid of it yet. It explains both the tidal response data and the water step data and potentially the triggering data. But I think it would, when we had to explain the low-pass filter, that evidence was not the strongest evidence in this talk. So, is that the answer? Long-range triggering is a result of fluid flow driven by seismic waves into faults? And the fluid flow can unclog fluid pathways or rearrange fluid pressures? I'm sure you're about to suggest some other possibilities. There are things we can do to try to answer it, but that's provisionally my answer right now. So, thanks for hanging out late, and are there any more questions? Okay.
When you say that you are looking for a threshold for activation, the frequency, maybe stress, or energy, are you considering the fact that there will be a lot of dispersion, a lot of noise? So why there should be one threshold? And it may be that you're in a noise level, but one day the fault is stuck, and so even a small, a large amplitude will not trigger anything, but another day the fault is very on the verge of sleeping, and then even a small peak will trigger.
That sounded like a question to me.
I
thought there was a question in there. To rephrase what I think your question is, what about time variable thresholds? Why does this threshold have to be stationary over time?
Constant.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Fair enough. It's possible that there are time variable thresholds. We still, if that's the case, we still have, first of all, there's a piece of evidence against that. If you think that these systems, for instance, have to recover before they can build up a threshold again, there are cases where at the geysers where we have triggered very rapidly after each other. We have one earthquake, and then 2 months later, we have another earthquake that does the same thing. So it does seem to be a repeatable effect. And then the second, perhaps more pertinent remark is that even if the threshold is time variable, we still have a problem with the amplitude of the waves, and we haven't really solved that. particularly for more conventional mechanisms like frictional instabilities or subcritical crack growth, that that amplitude of the waves problem doesn't go away even if it's a time variable threshold. Yeah. Either one?
Well, I'll make a comment that I've made when you've talked before, but this audience hasn't heard it, and that is that A, I find these arguments convincing, but in the end, you still probably have to have some kind of frictional instability. I think what you're explaining is a local stressing mechanism, which through a frictional instability can trigger an earthquake. So it's not the complete explanation, but it provides a way of increasing local stresses, at least on some pieces of fault, to be able to trigger earthquakes during earthquakes, I believe.
And I think we agreed on this point before.
I want to clarify.
Yeah, yes. No, and I was trying to be careful when I said that we do this, and then there's the frictional instability. So that frictional instability is still part of the story, but it's being driven by this extra pore pressure effect. Okay.
Supercritical fractures, not subcritical fractures.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's a small increment of pressure, but then you have to ask, where is the small increment of pressure taking place?
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you have a dike, you have essentially a long crack. I mean, you can show the picture where this is. A small increment in pressure on a crack is kind of like using a scissors. In a sense, to you know, small increment of pressure on the scissors will cut your finger here because you're concentrating the stresses. This could happen too, and you're just nucleating this pre-existing fracture. When it does, boom, the level of the welds goes down because that's sitting inside this fracture. And then you see an increased response to seismic shaking because, well, okay, it's a new fracture, hasn't had time to heal or anything, so a bit more responsive.
I think the real test of what I had deferred this conversation, but what my problem with that, and maybe you can solve this problem for me, is that the response keeps returning to a normal level. So if we are making extra fractures supercritically, then those are healing up to the same level every time. And is there some reason that ought to happen?
Your fracture's going to heal.
Over what time scale is it going to heal? And why should it keep healing exactly the same amount?
Well, it's a hairline.
Can't be a hairline if it's affecting permeability.
It's opening up. It's flowing into this.
So then it's not hairline.
It's flowing into pores or something. Messy system. And then
if there's water in it, it's not hairline. Right? Agree with me here.
Okay. you have a pocket.
Mm-hmm.
At the edge of this pocket, you have a crack,
mm-hmm.
a thinner crack that opens up. And that connects to other little pockets because it's a crappy mm-hmm. system anyway. It's got pockets all over the place. Then eventually, just as you talked about unclogging, you have reclogging. That should happen. If it's a small thing,
I think that's basically what
I'm saying, yes. And I guess what I've been trying to get away from is actually making new fractures, is this supercritical crack growth. Because I don't see how, I get, maybe we are saying the same thing, because how are we getting rid of these barriers ultimately in the end is we're making this extra flow that washes it away, and you could think about that in a way as cracking up the barriers. So in that sense, maybe that's what you're saying. But what I've been trying to avoid is having the fracture grow extra, because I don't know how to heal that up and reproduce in a way that we keep coming back to the same level. And if you can provide me with a way to do that, then I'd be perfectly happy with supercritical crack growth.
In some of the books, I've seen that after the The water level is not really the same as
okay. The water level step plots are very confusing because you have to detrend a seasonal signal because Oregon has seasonal rains. The better place to look to approach that question really is the tidal plots, because there are a number of advantages of the tides. One of which is that they measure a larger area of the aquifer at once because the wavelength of tides, so it's not so sensitive to local variations. You could also, you don't have the seasonal problems to pull that out. So let's look at the tides. And yeah, it's messy. I mean, it's not like it's a steady level here. And there does seem to be a particularly, perhaps, a systematic offset coming in at Landers, maybe. That was actually when we first started this study. We thought we were going to be looking at systematic offsets, and then Jean found this other thing that was much more interesting to study. There is another pair of wells on site that are connected that actually do have a systematic offset at the time of Landers. But overall, I mean, look here, and then look here. I mean, exactly the same may be overstating the case, but pretty much the same, I don't think it is.
Maybe I missed it, but what's the reason this mechanism is not written in the Japanese system?
I didn't say. There are two main things that are different about Japan than the Western U.S. One is the background level of seismicity is way higher. So you get this kind of shaking much, much more often. And two is that it's predominantly a compressional regime rather than extensional regime. And so at this point, observationally, we can't really say which of those is the more important effect for reducing long-range triggering. We can make some guesses, though. And our guesses are, if unclogging is the way to go, then if you have a very high background level of seismicity, you're actually removing these barriers all the time, and you never are building up enough pore pressure behind the barriers. You have to let that barrier sit there and get good and thick before you have enough pressure to actually make an earthquake. And so maybe this constant shaking has released all the barriers that are there. And so that would be one explanation. Another explanation is that it is actually easier to trigger earthquakes in extensional settings than compressional settings. You need smaller threshold stresses to do so. And so maybe just the stresses aren't large enough to do this in the compressional setting if we had really, really big earthquakes in Japan, which we will have sooner or later. We'll see more of it.
On that subject, I seem to recall that Kira Kanamori gave a talk, I noticed in the paper, but she had a whole list of cases from Japan with distant trigger. Am I remembering that?
It's sort of. He does have a talk that he gives on this, or Dave, I don't think he's giving it recently. And a whole list would be something of an overstatement. I believe there are two cases. Okay. There are isolated cases. There are, if you go through very carefully, and Hiro certainly did, you can find cases where it does look. None of his cases were as spectacular as this one in Denali. Wow, there goes the Western U.S. thing. They were over here in northwest Japan from this thing in Russia-China border or something. And so I'm not saying there isn't any. There's also a paper by Miyazawa and Mori that does triggering in Japan that sees some in Kyushu. Most of the cases that exist, including I think one of Hiro's, is in Kyushu, which is an extensional area. Everything else in Japan is pretty much compressional. So that's sort of balancing us, so maybe it's a compressional extensional effect. And Miyazawa and Mori is also in Kyushu. And there's also a case on Iwo Jima, where people have seen trigger in several cases on Iwo Jima.
Turkey
is, but Greece is not. The triggering was in Greece. Okay, so we're saying I've just broken your pointer. the triggered sites don't know anything about the original earthquake other than the seismic waves they see. So they don't know if it's compressional or extensional or anything else. And what matters is the tectonic regime at the location of triggering. We go back and forth, whether it's an extensional or a high seismicity thing in Japan. And Sumatra did do some triggering in Kyushu, maybe. Again, it's such a high signal like we see in the Western U.S. And I think that means something. And Hiro agrees with this. Jim Moore has also done a lot of work on this, agrees with this. Everybody agrees that, yeah, there might be something subtle going on in Japan, but you have to look for it real hard. And that means something.
Couple questions. One is, it was nice you had two different techniques for recording this permeability, one with the direct one with the waves, and the tidal one. If you go back and look at the tidal one and your Oregon wells where you have the direct measurement from the waves, are they consistent over the numbers and the time scale of recovery and all that?
I'm sorry, can you ask that question again?
Okay, so you did pinion flat, you did the tidal inference of some permeability changes. And then Oregon, you sort of showed inferences from the direct well pairs. If you do the tidal signal at the Oregon wells, is it consistent with the...
We don't get a tidal change, tidal phase change at Oregon. And my explanation for that is we're looking at, for the most part, at very local effects near the well, which is both the power and the problem with looking at water level steps. Is the power is you can, have this real scalpel kind of instrument on very short wavelength, but you can get very thrown off by something very, very local. And so averaged over the, 10 meters or so that you actually sample in a tidal response, you don't really see it at Oregon.
And the second question was, you keep talking about it as flushing out these particles as if they're sort of little mechanical things, but isn't it much more a chemical sort of clogging, a precipitation in chemistry space rather than particulate space?
Well, possibly. I'm being slightly deliberately vague about the source it precipitates. In the case of Grants Pass, in the case of the Oregon well, there's no evidence for any active chemistry there. We did some chemistry on the water, but there is evidence for particulate clays, dirt. So that's sort of why I went that route. In the case of geothermal systems, sure, it's a chemical process. But the chemistry is probably not acting on the time scale of 10 or 20 second waves. So in placing the barriers, absolutely, is probably a chemical process. But removing them is a mechanical process.
Sure.
Okay, so that's what I'm thinking there. Is that answer?
Yeah, no, I mean, imagine it was a mechanical breaking of a chemical seal.
Yes.
As opposed to a little clay particle seal. You're saying...
I think it could be either. I think it could be either. One of the slides I skipped in the interest of time was little clay particles in the Oregon well. Okay. Thanks.